Welcome, welcome, friends, to ArtCast. Hey, I'm so glad you joined me today because today we have the classic ArtCast format that started it all with ArtCast number 7. And in this series, we're talking about model-driven development. We're asking, is this likely to gain widespread adoption? Will it make building software faster, better, or cheaper? Well, listen up, because we have some experts on the line who are going to give you their opinion. First up, Stephen Kelly. Stephen is the CTO of Metacase and co-founder of the DSM Forum. Stephen is an organizer of Uppsala workshops on domain-specific modeling. Steve has authored articles in journals such as Dr. Dobbs and Object Spectrum, and he's a member of the editorial board for the Journal of Database Management. Let's welcome Stephen Kelly.
Hi, this is Steve Kelly from Metacase. Bram Selig said that in model-driven development, the model is dominant. I'd have thought that, whilst worth stating, that should be quite self-evident by now, so it was strange to hear Jack Greenfield disagree. Jack said that in their DSL tools, he doesn't want models to be dominant over code. This might be related to what Steve Cook said in the ArcTalk podcast, that Microsoft only expect their DSL tools to be able to generate 40 to 80% of code. Of course, the tools are only at a pre-beta stage so far, so hopefully as they mature over a few versions, Microsoft will find they start believing more in the approach and in their tools' ability to deliver a much higher percentage of a product from models. That was certainly true for us back in 1995. It took our customers to show us that 100% code generation really could be done. But since there's a possibility for misunderstanding here, let's make clear what we're talking about in terms of generating a full product. Almost any product shipped today will contain a large amount of third-party or in-house code that was not produced specifically for that project, but is reused over many projects, and often by many companies. That's not code we'd expect to see modeled or generated, not as part of that project. No, what we're interested in is the new code needed for that product or project. Before, that would have been written by hand. Now, we're aiming at 100% generation of that code, and often we can meet that target. It may be hard to believe until you see it, but I'm sure it was hard for people to believe that code in languages like C could effectively replace assembler. Of course, there's always the chance of some new feature in our next product requiring something not yet in our modeling language or generators. But that's no problem. We can either add it to the language or generators if we think it's going to be useful in the future, or then if it's a one-off thing, we can simply code it by hand like we used to. This then is similar to how we use components now. Normally, we can work through a high-level API, but sometimes we need to drop down to a lower level to do something special. Providing that's the exception, not the rule, is not a problem. After all, developers of games and embedded software are still used to having to drop right down to the level of assembler for a few critical tweaks. And whatever we do, we'll always be building on top of a stack of these lower levels of code, assembler, binary signals, analog signals, right down to the joys of quantum physics. The great thing in raising the level of abstraction is that these are then somebody else's problem. They build compilers, assemblers, and chips that automatically transform our input progressively down to the very lowest level where things actually happen. As Bram Selig rightly pointed out, that raise in the level of abstraction and automation is what makes our lives easier and more productive. In other words, domain-specific modeling does to code what compilers did to assembler.
Our next panelist is Martin Danner. Martin Danner founded ArrowRock Corporation in 1998. He is a PMI project management professional, a Microsoft certified solution developer for the .NET framework, and a Microsoft Architect MVP. Let's welcome Martin Danner.
Hi, this is Martin Danner with ArrowRock Corporation in Boise, Idaho. I want to start out today by talking about the modeling wars. Much is made about the feud between Microsoft's software factories and the UMG's Model-Driven Architecture Framework, or MDA. A fair amount of polarizing rhetoric has been bandied about, and clearly there are some sharp opinions on the subject. One gets the impression that it's an either-or proposition, that you're either in the MDA camp or the software factories camp. Well, I've had a close look at both, and I can tell you that it's remarkable how they share many of the same basic concepts. For instance, both describe a method for designing systems at some predefined level of abstraction, and then converting that design into an implementation of one sort or another through a predefined transformation process. Also, both employ the notion of viewpoints and views. Simply put, a viewpoint is a type of model, say a class diagram, whereas a view is an instance of that model for a specific system, for example, a class diagram of an accounts receivable module. So what's all the fuss about? As far as I can tell, this is the main difference. In MDA, all the modeling is done using UML and its companion Object Constraint Language, or OCL. The software factory, on the other hand, does not constrain the modeling to any particular language. Rather, it employs the notion of a domain-specific language, or DSL. A DSL is custom-tailored to express the concepts of the domain being modeled. Unlike UML, which defines a single modeling language, there can be many different DSLs, just as there are many different domains to be modeled. What's more, you can invent your own DSL to create a modeling environment that perfectly fits the domain you're working in. Believe me, when that little nugget of truth sinks in, you get this aha moment that's really quite liberating. Now, I'm not saying that UML doesn't work. Actually, it's a very useful tool. In fact, I use it all the time. No, the point I'm trying to make is that UML may not always be the right tool for the job. UML is designed to model a specific domain, namely object-oriented software systems. In other words, UML is a domain-specific language designed to model object-oriented software systems. Think about it. This is really a key point, so I'm going to say it again. The UML is a domain-specific language designed to model object-oriented software systems. All well and good, you might say, because in the end, we're all building object-oriented systems anyway. But you need to ask yourself, why should I limit myself to this one level of abstraction? Sure, the software systems you're building are object-oriented, but is it possible, even desirable, to design your own software systems at an even higher level of abstraction? Let me explain what I mean. Imagine, if you will, that you could take your application domain and organize it into reusable elements, where each element represents some well-defined bit of functionality. Now, take your elements and put them into a toolbox to create your very own custom modeling environment. Next, drag and drop those elements onto a design surface, configure each element as needed, and wire them together in a way that represents the application that you want to build. Finally, with the push of a button, transform your design into a clean, tight code using templates that you know are good because you created them. Touch up your application if needed with your own custom code that comfortably coexists with the generated code. Compile and serve with a garnish of system documentation also generated automatically. And there you have it, a fully baked software application built in a fraction of the time from reusable assets. What I just described is the essence of domain-specific modeling. Sounds like a dream of some distant future, doesn't it? Actually, you've been able to do it for several years now with a product called MetaEdit Plus from Metacase, which was co-founded by one of our panelists, Stephen Kelly. And now you can do it in Visual Studio 2005 using the DSL Tools Extensibility Kit. Both products come with tutorials and samples to get you started. I've gone through them and found them to be a very useful learning experience. Software factories are very similar to domain-specific modeling, but extend it in important new ways. For instance, a software factory might utilize multiple domain-specific languages to model a system from different viewpoints, and then combine and transform those models in various ways to produce a variety of development artifacts that include source code files, configuration files, SQL scripts, test cases, deployment manifests, system documentation, and so on. Also, software factories expand generative programming capabilities through guidance automation. Guidance automation provides context-sensitive, just-in-time guidance in the form of templates, recipes, and wizards for the creation of an entire solution or an individual project or even a single project item. The Guidance Automation Toolkit, or GAT, has kept a low profile so far, but I understand that the Microsoft Patterns and Practices team will begin releasing their application blocks as guidance packages in 2006. So you'll be hearing a lot more about it soon. Of course, there's more to software factories than what I've just described. In fact, if you pick up and read the book on software factories by Jack Greenfield and company, you'll soon find that it goes really deep. But don't let that discourage you. I recommend that while you're reading the software factories book, or perhaps rereading it, that you run through the tutorials from Microsoft's DSL tools and the Metacase MetaEdit Plus product. Get started with something simple, and then expand your horizons from there. I'll wrap up by saying that I think model-driven development has the potential of becoming a disruptive technology that fundamentally changes the way that we all build software. Domain-specific modeling and its more elaborate offspring, software factories, holds a great deal of promise. In the next and final installment of this panel discussion, I'll talk about what it will take for widespread adoption of model-driven development to occur, and I'll also share with you my humble opinion regarding the question originally posed to this panel, which is model-driven development ready for prime time? One final comment, a request actually. I'd really like to know what your thoughts are on the subject, as well as any questions this discussion may have sparked. So please take a minute and add your comments to the Channel 9 webpage for this podcast.
Our third and final panelist for this episode is Jack Greenfield. Jack is an architect for the Enterprise Frameworks and Tools team at Microsoft. He was previously Chief Architect, Practitioner Desktop Group at Rational Software Corporation, and founder and CTO of Inline Software Corporation. Let's welcome Jack Greenfield.
Hi, this is Jack Greenfield with Week 3. I'd like to respond to the comments that Martin Danner makes in this week's Arcast session. I agree with Martin that MDD has the potential to become a disruptive technology that significantly improves the way we build software. And I'm looking forward to hearing his comments about what it will take to make modeling mainstream. I have to disagree, however, with some of the other things he said, especially his claim that software factories and MDA are similar when all is said and done. To support his claim, he says that both use models to describe systems at a higher level of abstraction, and then use transformation to produce the implementation. He later says that the result of this process, after some manual touch-up, is a fully baked application. Well, that doesn't sound like what we're doing with software factories today. He also suggests that software factories and MDA take essentially the same approach to views and viewpoint. If you heard my comments in Arcast Sessions 5 and 6, you'll have heard me say several things that make it hard for me to agree with Martin on this topic. I'll repeat them here briefly because they're quite important to understanding why software factories are not MDA. First, while software factories can use models, they don't focus on models. Instead, they focus on defining the development process for family-related systems, and then on supporting that process with reusable assets. Yes, it's true that some of those assets may be models or modeling tools, but software factories explicitly integrate modeling with more traditional development methods and practices. And some of the assets may be templates or patterns or best practice guidelines or class libraries. As I explained in Session 5, we don't always know enough about every aspect of a problem domain to model it. We can, however, identify some of those aspects and capture information about how each aspect should be addressed in the development process. This focus on more traditional development methods and practices is not merely window dressing. In fact, I believe it's critical to avoiding the overpromising and underdelivery that doomed CASE to failure. MDA's failure to integrate modeling with more traditional development methods and practices is a legitimate reason for concern, in my opinion, that it will suffer a similar fate. Second, while software factories can use transformation, they don't focus on transformation. Instead, they focus on defining viewpoints from which different stakeholders participate in the development process, and on managing the artifacts appropriate to each viewpoint. This artifact management may at times involve transformation, such as transforming a logical data model into a physical one, but more often than not, it involves other types of operations across the relationships between viewpoints, such as trace, validation, or analysis. As I explained in Session 5, the reason is that we don't always know enough about a given pair of viewpoints or about how they relate to each other to transform artifacts between them automatically. In my opinion, recognizing the limits of our knowledge of arbitrary problem domains and the limitations of the technologies we're offering to the marketplace is critical to the success of model-driven development. The general claim that applications of any stripe can be generated in their entirety from models fully baked is just not credible. Worse, it undermines the credibility of legitimate efforts to improve productivity through the pragmatic and judicious application of model-driven technologies in the context of more traditional development methods and practices. MDA's focus on transformation gives legitimate fodder to the critics of model-driven development, in my opinion. Third, I find it hard to agree with Martin's suggestion that software factories and MDA take essentially the same approach to views and viewpoints. Yes, the PIM and PISM defined by MDA can be seen as viewpoints. However, MDA does not explicitly incorporate the notion of viewpoint, nor does it provide a way to define or reason about viewpoints. In order to see PIM and PISM as viewpoints, we first have to learn to think about software development in terms of viewpoints through some other methodology, and then interpret MDA in those terms. More importantly, the number of viewpoints we can ascribe to MDA is fixed at two. There's one PIM and one PISM. MDA doesn't give us a way to define or reason about requirements or logical architecture or implementation or deployment or technical architecture or testing or operational management or maintenance or lifecycle processes for a family of systems in terms of a set of viewpoints and the relationships among them. Software factories, by contrast, are explicitly based on viewpoints and relationships between viewpoints. In fact, software factories is a methodology for defining and reasoning about viewpoints. To say that software factories and MDA both use viewpoints is like saying that monkeys and humans both use computers. Sure, we see monkeys playing with keyboards, and they might appear to be using the computers, but monkeys are presumably unaware of the significance of the computers, and certainly can't be expected to design new ones. In short, Martin's summary of software factories and MDA is essentially a summary of MDA. I suppose that if we were to describe software factories only in terms of MDA, ignoring the very real differences between them that I've just described, then yeah, we could superficially claim that the two technologies are similar. But I hope you can see from what I've just said about software factories that that's a bit like claiming that a unicycle and a Ferrari are similar because they both have wheels. Well, the problem with such a claim is that it casts two things as similar despite the fact that the differences between them are far more significant than the similarities. Martin also claims that UML is a domain-specific language for modeling OO software systems. The problem I have with this claim is that for a language to function effectively as a DSL in a model-driven development paradigm, the domain has to be narrow enough to allow the language to be fit to purpose. If the domain is too broad, then the information captured by models expressed in the DSL will be too general to support the kind of high-fidelity code generation we're looking for. I believe the track record of code generation from UML proves this point. Of course, high-fidelity code generation is indeed possible when the UML is heavily decorated with stereotypes and tags, but at that point, the UML has merely become a DSL for some other domain. In other words, UML profiles are just a clunky way of defining DSLs. In the book, we suggest the term general-purpose language for languages like UML that are designed to describe almost anything. So to sum up, calling undecorated UML a DSL is a bit like calling an axe a scalpel. Sure, they both cut things, but the axe is a general-purpose cutting tool, while the scalpel is a cutting tool that's been carefully designed for a very specific purpose. And the attention paid to the requirements of the problem domain, in the case of the scalpel, makes all the difference.
And the debate rages on. What do you think? Will these models really change anything? I remember using model type stuff for ages. It always seemed to me that these tools were okay for certain things. But I don't know. I find it hard to believe that 100% of my application could ever be generated by a model. And then there's always the ways in which models are somewhat static over time. They don't really adapt to new ways of looking at things, like, you know, the move from object-oriented kind of based systems to component-based systems to service-based systems. I don't think the models have kept up. But who knows? Maybe things will be different this time. Maybe. What do you think? Post your comments, and we'll see you next time on ArcCast.